I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Howdy, Mark Kenny here from ANU's Australian Studies Institute with this week's Democracy Sausage. In government, they say never waste a crisis, which means if there are changes to be made, difficult reforms, do them when you've got the voters' ear and normal service is being disrupted anyway. That's certainly been the case with the pandemic. Just about everything changed and government leaders had the people's attention like never before. Voters became familiar with Dan Andrews' North Face jacket and with previously anonymous public servants like Brendan Murphy and Brett Sutton. Happily, the government stopped talking about snapback quite a while ago, even if, ironically, that's what the economy seems to be doing rather enthusiastically now anyway. But there are long-running problems that predated the COVID crisis and which in some cases were more clearly exposed by forced shutdowns and other deprivations. Things like homelessness, extreme poverty, precarious casual employment, rental stress, other chronic health concerns, and inequality in everything from education to mobility to nutrition. And now we're into the vaccine stage, and again, decisions are being made which raise questions of efficacy, access, and future prosperity. Health Minister Greg Hunt made the point yesterday that Australia has had 31 days this year in which there has been no community transmission and no deaths added to the 910 strong death toll from 2020. So it's a good story and it's great that Australia is moving to this vaccine stage, but there are many challenges ahead, of course, and probably unforeseen setbacks as well. With me to discuss these matters are Professors Sharon Friel and Quentin Grafton. Sharon Friel is Professor of Health Equity and Director of the Menzies Centre for Health Governance at the ANU's School of Regulation and Global Governance. Quentin Grafton is Professor of Economics and Australian Laureate Fellow at the Crawford School of Public Policy. Welcome back to you both.
Good to be here, Mark.
Yeah, delighted to be here.
Now, let's look at this vaccine first. Quentin, you're an economist, so let me ask you a kind of a first up question. What can an economist bring to the considerations around the vaccine rollout?
Well, it's a matter of major public policy, but in terms of my credentials, it's really about knowing how to model and understanding statistics. So there's been publications in The Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, in terms of the public trials associated, trial threes and associated with these various vaccines. So I can read that, I can understand that, I can understand statistics, I understand what's going on in other parts of the world, so I can give some analysis towards that. I don't claim to be a virologist, I don't claim to be able to talk through the details of those particular vaccines in terms of what one does vis-a-vis the other in the context of those issues, but I can certainly talk to numbers and I'll be happy to do that today. I've also published in the area of COVID. I've worked with public health professionals and written several papers over the last 12 months in the area of COVID.
Well, the ability to read statistics is you know, a skill in itself, I suppose. I mean, all economists presumably can do that, but we've seen a lot of homespun or autodidactic epidemiologists emerge through this crisis, and that's a good thing in a lot of ways. It's great to see the level of public engagement that we've seen with this issue. People have become conversant with, I think, a whole lot of government processes, with health terms, with the idea of testing, of you know, clinical trials, some of the principles that are involved there, the R number, you know, the reproduction rate of the virus, all these kinds of things have come forward. So it's a rich and fascinating area, and I guess we've all got a lot of skin in this game.
We sure do.
So let's look at a few. Let's sort of break it down. Efficacy is obviously a big issue. What can we learn about efficacy from the modelling that we've seen?
Well, there's the published data, so this is empirical data, and then there's also data that we're collecting at the moment, or the Israelis, the UK, the Americans are collecting in relation to these vaccines. And the efficacy really is about whether you get symptoms relative to a control group. So the people who've been vaccinated vis-a-vis the people who are in a control group who don't get the actual vaccine, and you compare the level of whether they've come down with symptoms, and then you can also compare whether they have had symptoms, have they been taken to hospital, or have they ended up dying. So in terms of efficacy, that's what we're talking about. So you get the vaccine, you don't get symptoms. It means that you it's been efficacious in respect to you. And you do it in a trial, and then you do it out in the general public, so to speak, which is what's happening right now in a number of countries. So the efficacy varies. So these vaccines are not the same. They're made in different ways, they're produced in different locations, and they've been applied in different countries. So it is hard to make those comparisons. But certainly the Pfizer vaccine, which has been applied in Israel, about over 90% of Israelis at least had their first dose. It's a two-dose type of vaccine, and it seems to be highly efficacious, which basically means if you get the vaccination, certainly with the two vaccinations, the chances of you getting symptoms associated with COVID-19 are much, much reduced. It's maybe 95% efficacy. So that's a very good vaccine. If you want to get a good vaccine, that's certainly the one that's very efficacious. Another vaccine is AstraZeneca, which is being employed in the United Kingdom along with the Pfizer vaccine. And AstraZeneca is also going to be employed here in Australia. In fact, the 300,000 vials are coming in just as we speak, so to speak. And the Pfizer vaccine, of course, is already underway in terms of vaccinations within Australia. The AstraZeneca efficacy is less than the Pfizer. How much less, that's the dispute, okay? But certainly from the data we have available from The Lancet, that's a medical journal, that's where they publish the stats associated with the trials, it's between 62 and 70%. It might be higher, but we don't know. But that's certainly what the data tells us. So that's a big difference. So that means it's a vaccine that you want to get. If you haven't got any choices, you'd certainly want to get the AstraZeneca.
Well, at the start of this process, we would have all taken that with
absolutely.
All those of us who are sort of not, you know, kind of paranoid about vaccines, would have all taken those
absolutely.
Sort of numbers. I mean, that's still pretty good, right?
Oh, absolutely. So, and efficacy is very different to safety. So I just want to stress this to everybody listening. So we're not talking about safety. These vaccines are safe. The AstraZeneca vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, and the Novavax that we're going to be getting later on in the year. So all of them are safe. So we're talking about the ability to stop getting symptoms. And the Pfizer vaccine, and the data we currently have available to us, is more efficacious than the AstraZeneca. Now that makes a difference on a population level. On an individual, maybe it doesn't make too much difference, but on a population level, it makes a difference. And this gets to this issue of herd immunity. So herd immunity is essentially when we vaccinated enough people with a vaccine that has sufficient efficacy, then if we get the virus coming back in from arrivals from overseas, for example, it doesn't turn into an epidemic. That's sort of the holy grail that we'd like to get to at some point. The problem with the AstraZeneca, because of its efficacy at 62 or 70%, is we were not going to get to herd immunity by AstraZeneca alone, even if we have very high rates of vaccination. So that means that Australia, will not have herd immunity under the current vaccine rollout by the end of 2021. We might do later on if we add on an additional vaccine for those people who've had AstraZeneca, et cetera, et cetera. So those are big issues. And they're big issues not at the moment in March 2021, but they're going to be big issues after a federal election, increasing pressure to open up the borders. The Business Council of Australia made an announcement this morning. Qantas made an announcement last week about opening up international arrivals. And when they talk about opening up international arrivals, they're not talking about the two-week quarantine which we have at the moment. They're talking about allowing people to come in a much more freer way. So when that happens, it hasn't happened yet. It won't happen for a few months. But when that happens, then, and if we haven't got herd immunity, there is going to be more deaths.
Well, more risk anyway.
Well, certainly more risk. And so this is an issue that I think of great import, a public debate. I don't make these decisions. The prime ministers and premiers and chief ministers make these decisions along with the medical advice. But that's clearly something that we need to talk about. And the idea that we can just simply forget about it, oh, don't worry about it, is not relevant in this context. It's absolutely relevant because the closed borders, not just at a state level, but at an international level, is what saved Australia. The most important thing that we did in Australia was to close our borders and to ensure that when people arrived, they were quarantined. That protected us the most. Of anything I can think of, that was the most important thing that we did.
And to the extent that we had outbreaks, it was when that system broke down. So that kind of vindicates that point, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And of course, we can do, we can test, we can contact trace, we can do a number of things. We could do social distancing. We can wear masks when public transport and when we're inside. Those sorts of things do exist and there are options available to us. Most important factor of all was that we closed our borders. So if we open up our borders when we don't have herd immunity, and just go, we can go through the numbers, it's very straightforward. Okay, so we're talking 5.5 million people who are under the age of 18 in Australia, something around that number. They won't be vaccinated, okay? Very, very low risk in terms of them getting any symptoms. There is the possibility that they can also pass on symptoms. There's any cases of that. And then, of course, there's people who won't be vaccinated, but possibly a couple of million Australians won't be vaccinated. And then those people who are vaccinated with AstraZeneca.
Sorry, can I just stop you there? Those couple of million, that's people who choose not to be.
That is correct. Yeah. That is correct. And then you talk about the people who did choose to be vaccinated, but they got vaccinated with AstraZeneca and the efficacy at 70%. So you may be talking about 3 million or so Australians who won't have necessarily the protection that we would like them to have, let's say if they'd had the Pfizer vaccine. So we're talking millions of Australians, and that means we won't get the herd immunity, and it means that there will be potential loss of life if we open up our borders in a way that's not carefully done, not structured, doesn't take into account that, in fact, if we don't have herd immunity, we've got the real potential to have a major outbreak. So this is this issue about the vaccine rollout, the strategy, the timing, the sequencing. And there is a potential, there's a third vaccine that's coming our way. Novavax is coming our way at some point or other, perhaps in the second half of this year. That is also a highly efficacious vaccine, less than Pfizer, but much more than AstraZeneca based on the data we currently have. Now, so that's another possibility.
That's right. And the data we currently have is based on the clinical trials that these drugs have to go through in their respective jurisdictions. I mean, the TGA makes the decisions in relation to Australia. But those clinical trials aren't identical with each other, are they? I mean,
absolutely not. Different countries. So you've got some of them, Brazil and South Africa, they're quite useful to have in terms of your trials because of different variants, but also different age structures. So, and different times. They weren't all done at the same time. So that
and
makes
you don't have, for example, pregnant women participating in clinical trials, yet of course, they exist in the community.
Absolutely. And very old. So in the AstraZeneca trials, they had very few people who were over the age of 80. And so this is this issue about 100% of people who get AstraZeneca, 100% will not get serious symptoms. Well, we don't know that. The data doesn't tell us that simply because the very old people are the ones who would be the most likely to be hospitalized or suffer fatalities with COVID. So if you don't include enough of them in your trial, then you can't say for sure that that's 100% efficacy and associated with not getting serious symptoms. So at the point, we don't know. But we do have additional data. So remember, there are countries like Israel that have been vaccinating, and the United Kingdom started in December. Okay, so we now have 2 months of data. I'm going to getting more data as we go along. And certainly from Pfizer, the Pfizer vaccine, from Israel, there is very good preliminary data from Israel indicates there's a highly efficacious vaccine. Furthermore, it's effective at reducing transmission, which is another issue. They're not necessarily the same.
Yeah, yeah.
So efficacy is about you don't get the symptoms relative to a control group. Effectiveness is about you not transmitting it to someone else. So in other words, there are people who had COVID, asymptomatic, they don't have symptoms, but they can still be infectious. So we need to make sure that's effective. And apparently from the data, it looks like that does have some real value there. So that's another plus. And again, I just want to stress to everyone listening here, they're all safe. Okay? Yeah. It's not a question that AstraZeneca is not safe. It's not a question that Pfizer is not safe or Novavax is not safe. The issue here is about efficacy. Do you get symptoms? What's the probability of that? Effectiveness in the terms of stopping infections. Those are the issues. And then thinking about the other elements around our strategy. Remember the elements of testing, contact tracing, quarantine of people coming from overseas on arrival, those sorts of things. We can't just let them go come October, okay, where everyone's got been vaccinated who said they want to be vaccinated. We still will not have herd immunity at that point. So we'll need to be able to think through very carefully the public health issues. That's for public health people to think through, but don't be misinformed by people who would like us to open up borders very quickly simply because we've all been vaccinated. That's not the strategy that we need to follow. We need to follow a staggered sequence strategy and also be informed by what's happened in the UK, US, Israel, those countries that are way ahead in terms of their vaccinations.
Sharon, that's going to be one of the big problems, one of the big challenges, isn't it, is maintaining levels of public vigilance, maintaining levels of political commitment to these kinds of restrictions that Quinton was talking about that have got us to where we are now, to the relatively happy place that we are now. But once the vaccination programs are rolling out and there's a sense that that people feel even more immune from the disease, it's going to be much harder to make the argument that borders should be closed, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're moving into it's going to be a very, very challenging political and governance time. I think, really important to remember that within Australia, we've been incredibly compliant. Unlike many other countries around the world, we have been incredibly compliant. And I think we have to applaud that for each of us within society. We have to applaud that. And so the how do we help people continue to adhere to some of these public health measures going forward becomes a challenge. But remembering that the Australian public have been so good in responding to this.
They've been good, but I've spoken about this on the podcast before, but some people describe it as in almost like a negative, that we've been very obedient. But it's more that there's relatively high levels of trust in Australia, it turns out, for medical expertise, for health officials, and for the evidence that we could see it from overseas. We could see, the early fatalities in the pandemic that we suffered here, and Australians understood, along with their officials, what needed to be done, which is different from just simple blind obedience, isn't it?
Oh, well, absolutely. And again, I think to applaud in the way that Quinton was describing, the evidence and the use of evidence. We've had, a very consistent message coming from our chief medical officers, at the federal and the state level. There's consistent messaging, the range of expertise that's been used to communicate that. So I think there's been a very successful communication strategy. And as you say, that's been really important in terms of enabling trust among the public. So, yeah, it's not blind obedience. But I mean, I just marvel, you know, when I talk with colleagues and family across the world, and they're like, yeah, why would you just do that? Why would you just stay at home?
Well, you know, people are amazed when they abroad, when they see that Australia would shut down a state on the strength of, say, one infection or two infections breaking out into the community. But the numbers don't lie.
Yeah.
It's worked for us.
Yeah.
Now, there have been some economic hardships associated with that, and the government has – governments have stepped in and provided all kinds of different supports there, and that's been absolutely crucial. So it's the integration of all of these things that's really worked very well in Australia so
far. Yes, yes. I mean, one thing I would sort of pick up following Quentin's remarks is, you know, that hasn't happened equally across the country. And certainly when we talk about the vaccine, you know, the equity issue that is fundamental within Australia, but also globally. So when we think about who and how of getting access to the vaccine, and I know colleagues within the committee that are thinking about the rollout for the vaccine across the country are thinking about equity issues, but it has to be front and centre, because what we know through the course of the pandemic so far within Australia, and Mark, you mentioned the government's the various sort of economic and social responses associated with the lockdown. The most socially disadvantaged groups in society are really hurting. It's not been okay for everybody within society. You know, if you've got to stay at home, that's okay. If you've got all of the sort of the resources and the capital to stay at home, or that you've got the type of job that allows you to do that. If you've got a home, if you've got a safe environment in a home. So there's all sorts of variability within, you know, within Australia and globally, of course. So when we're thinking about the going forward and, you know, how we maintain the sorts of great measures that we have put in place, what we haven't addressed are the underlying social issues that are creating all sorts of problems for people. And the health consequence of that, not the COVID-related health consequence, but the physical and the mental health consequences from the pressures of COVID and the underlying, basically, social inequities are going to be phenomenal. Going forward, you know, we think we've got a problem with COVID, but the tail of this is going to be quite significant. And unless we think about that from a public policy perspective, then we're doing the under the lamplight epidemiology. We used to speak about, I'm a lapsed epidemiologist, I should say. You know, you speak about under the lamplight. You know, you only look at what's under the light from the lamp, and you forget the fact that there's all of this out here that's really a major health issue. So I hope we, if the Prime Minister is listening, please fix that.
Look, we will talk about some of these social aspects of it in just a moment. We'll take a quick break, but we'll come back and we'll talk about your concept of a social vaccine, but also just the way this rollout has begun. So back in a moment.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
All right, welcome back. Now, Sharon, just before the break, we were talking about the equity issues around the vaccine. We've seen I mean, Quentin made the point about the Pfizer vaccine having, very good efficacy according to clinical trials, 95%, this kind of thing. I don't think we'd be going out on a limb if we said that most people, if given a choice, would take the most efficacious vaccine. So there instantly is a question about who gets Pfizer and who gets the subsequent rollout, you know, the subsequent iterations of the vaccine program, which is AstraZeneca and down the track Novavax, among others. What did you think about the Prime Minister getting the second dose of Pfizer? I mean, that's been a tradition, if you can have traditions established in weeks and months, but it's all been happening quite quickly, but that's the way the world works at the moment. Certainly been the practice in a number of other polities as well, where government leaders have led off with, being filmed, having the vaccine first up or second up, whatever it is. The argument being that it's about establishing confidence. Quentin has stressed the point quite rightly a couple of times that these vaccines are safe. It's a big issue, this idea of public confidence. That's clearly the logic of the PM having the Pfizer vaccine. But do you perceive equity concerns about some people getting it and some people not getting as good a one?
Yeah, well, I suppose to remember, as Quentin said, the vaccines are safe. Mm-hmm. And the vaccines are a very good thing to have. You know, we didn't have a vaccine before and now we've got a choice of vaccines. So whichever one you're getting, it's really important that you get it, full stop. Who gets what then throws up the equity question. So, like, you know, with the Prime Minister, getting the second up to get the Pfizer. I think, as you say, it's about the building of confidence. We've got, you spoke earlier of, you know, we've got high levels of trust within Australia with the government. And I think it's just so important that we see the leader of the country up there getting a vaccine. That's to help encourage us to...
I just step in? Mm. So I think it should have been done differently. It looked like a publicity stunt, and yes, that's good to everyone see that, but why couldn't the Prime Minister be there with the Leader of the Opposition or the Leader of the Greens? Why couldn't it be there with the Governor General? Why couldn't it have been there with people who are stars in the context of arts and culture or sports? Have a dozen well-known Australians all getting the vaccine at the same time. That would have been a much better look from my perspective. Mm. And I just want to highlight there are Prime Ministers in other countries who've decided to wait their turn. So Justin Trudeau in Canada and Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand. So the question is, someone who is low risk, relatively low risk in the case of the Prime Minister, gets a vaccine, it means that someone else who is high risk, and because there's a bunch of people who are in their 80s and older who haven't yet received the Pfizer vaccine. So I think that's an issue, and there's an issue of equity, it's an issue of what it looks like. And so, yeah, I have concerns about that. I don't think it should have been a one-man show with him and a very respectful lady. I think it needed to be a much bigger deal in the context of other well-known Australians. And
there'd be criticisms either way, though, wouldn't there? I mean, yeah. If you had a bunch of celebrities, for example, because the first vaccine that's being rolled out happens to be the best one and it happens to be in limited supply, I think the question of, the sort of A-listers are getting the good one, we're getting the sort of...
I would have said half of them get the AstraZeneca and half of them get...
they didn't have AstraZeneca.
But they didn't, not at the time. No, they didn't. But look...
I think Greg Hunt, to be fair, was asked about this and said he would be taking the AstraZeneca.
As is Murphy, I understand. But I don't want to get petty and trivial about it.
No.
But these are issues. And we know from the United Kingdom, although they're doing a really good job with the National Health Service in terms of the rollout of their vaccines. I mean, it was a disaster in 2020. And part of the disaster was the communication from the top. So communication from the top really does matter. This gets to what Sharon was saying in terms of compliance, obedience, however you want to will, whatever you want to call it. That's critical to hear. So that getting the right messaging, both in the vaccinations, the social distancing, all that stuff is critical here. And that we need to have that confidence and trust that the people are making the right calls. They're not putting themselves ahead of the queue, all those sorts of things. So maybe it seems trivial for me to raise this, but I think it is a communication issue. And I would, that's going to be critical for us going forward.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, from an equity sense, whether it's the Prime Minister and a few others getting this vaccine versus that vaccine, in the grand scheme of equity within Australia, that's tiny. Mm. There are so many other issues. So I would hate for the Prime Minister to be able to think, well, if I grapple with this pure PR, of course, issue, I'd rather he pays attention to some of these other much bigger policy issues that, frankly, are getting left off of the hook because of the... And rightfully, we should, of course, be speaking about the vaccine and access to the vaccine. But that can't be the only thing if we want to talk about your health.
Okay, well, I'm going to yield to that very strong hint. But before I do so, I want to ask you one more question in your capacity as a public health expert and a lapsed epidemiologist. Is there a concern that we will be outrun in this orderly rollout by variants of the vaccine, of the pandemic, the pathogen?
There's a concern. It's always a concern. And I'm going to ask Quentin to come in. I don't know if Quentin and colleagues have done any modelling with this. But of course, we've seen that around the world where these variants are coming in, and partly through the travel mechanisms that Quentin was...
And the vaccine tends to be either less efficacious, we think, with those variants. And so that challenges your whole program of trying to get to herd immunity.
Well, it certainly does. So there's the South African variant. Okay, so the African government stopped the AstraZeneca rollout, not because of safety issues. So let me clear it, not about safety. It's just the question of the efficacy. Mm. So based on 2,000 people, in terms of what the numbers are, very preliminary numbers, they didn't think the efficacy was high enough in relation to the South African variant. It was just over 20%. That's not good enough. So that is an issue. So they're now moving to an alternatives. In fact, they already have in South Africa. So that is an issue. So that South African variant isn't just found in South Africa. It exists in Europe. It exists in other parts of the world. In fact, it came into New Zealand, into Australia as well. Mm. So those are issues. And so I think this is about the issue of continuing to vaccinate, improve. And I believe the fact we've already done it once shows that we can certainly do it again for these variants. So I'm confident that that will be the case, but I'm not a virologist. So the question is will we need follow-up vaccinations? And the answer to that, I think, is almost certainly yes. Mm. And certainly for people who are going to be traveling overseas, they will need to be very conscious of, the vaccine they've received, the efficacy of that vaccine, and where they're going. Because there's places in the world that are going to have much higher rates of COVID-19, could in fact be endemic in those locations. And so without our adequate protection, with vaccination, adequate behaviours, of course, in terms of the sorts of things that we do in terms of social distancing, we'll be putting ourselves at risk, as well as, of course, people coming in who aren't properly quarantined, tested, all those sorts of things.
Which raises, because there's going to be enormous equity issues globally. I mean, if we think they're bad here, they're going to be enormous with some countries being much more slave to the virus, to variants of the virus, without proper public health systems and access to the vaccine for potentially millions, billions of people. That's an issue. Of course, then it raises the other question about vaccine passports that's come up, whether we'll get into a situation where first world people, for want of a better way of describing them, will be able to move around the world with, certification showing they've got the top level vaccination. I don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but it'd be hard. It's not hard to imagine it happening.
No, I think you're spot on. I think we're about to see a massive increase in inequities globally. We've got countries stockpiling vaccines, countries who are years away from getting access to, in low and middle income countries, years away from getting access to it. So you've got all of that.
Where they've got dysfunctional governments, for example.
As well, but also that there's all of the issues of access to affordable vaccines and, whether they... the global support for countries versus national responsibility. So all of that is raising its head. That's all about intellectual property rights around vaccines. Airlines starting to talk about you need to have a little, stamp that says you've had your... So the sorts of behaviours that we might and practices that we might have seen and would be associated with development. It's just going to, we're going to see a bifurcated, even more of a bifurcated world, I suspect. Which again comes back to the importance of addressing some of the underlying social inequities.
Now, this is this idea that you've talked about of a social vaccine, right? So I just want you to sort of explain that concept.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's just...
It's a metaphor, right?
Mm. It is just a language of reminding us that if we want to keep society in Australia and globally, if we want to keep us well, prevent further disease, we have to focus also on the social aspects of health and the social factors that contribute to health, not just the biomedical factors. And so the discussion around the vaccines that we've just been having is a part, is a very important part of dealing with disease. But what is it that causes disease to begin with? What is it that keeps us well? It's not a tablet or or an injection. It's the everyday conditions of our lives. And so the social aspect. And so to inoculate us, you know, to prevent us from having the symptoms of poor health or health inequities, to increase the effectiveness of keeping us well and preventing further disease, addressing these social factors that we've known for decades and decades and well, for much longer than that. So that's the idea of the social vaccine that we would roll, we must roll out a social vaccine. That's a very fancy way of saying healthy public policy.
So, but what you, what you're saying is that we can use this moment, if we're thinking politically and socially, we can use this moment of public awareness about health, leverage that to a broader understanding of, as you say, what makes us healthy, what makes us functional as a society, and sort of direct that attention in a much broader way than just at this particular virus crisis, if I can put it like that. And is there a concern in your mind that, I get both of your feelings on this, that what we've seen here with what we've variously described as obedience or compliance or cooperation and unit, social unity and however we describe it, is there a concern that that's because the leadership class, the middle class, those of us with you know, sort of economic and cultural power have been ourselves threatened all of a sudden by a clear and present danger to wit this virus? And suddenly the machinery of government, the machinery of our entire society has sort of swung into action to address this question, but we are far less activist, if I can put it like that, on endemic problems that exist in the periphery of our society for many, many people, whether it be you know, homelessness or diabetes or alcohol abuse or obesity or all a whole range of things that are, that afflict many people but which are really not addressed and which have very, very high death tolls even compared to COVID.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest health burden in Australia is non-communicable diseases. So things like diabetes, heart disease, cancers, respiratory diseases. They're the things that have and are continuing and will continue to make us sick and kill us. And the levels of premature mortality, you know, dying young from these conditions. There are very strong inequities within those conditions as well. And you know, just your point, Mark, of is it that we've seen a sort of almost like a universal response to COVID, which has supported and enabled a strong government intervention? Well, some of the groups within society who take most action around diabetes or obesity or cancers are the more affluent groups in society. You know, they're the ones that are sort of the first responders in terms of the early adopters of personal responsibility around that. But they are also the groups within society who have much greater financial and social capital that enables them to seek help or to make changes to their lives in ways that less affluent or socially marginalised groups don't. But you do raise that much bigger question, I think, of why is it that government does not intervene in the way that we've seen that they can intervene for this particular health crisis of COVID-19? Why do they not intervene in those structural factors that we know cause non-communicable diseases?
Can I just add to that? Because I think there's so many examples. I'm fully on board with what Sharon's saying. So take the issue of water, which I know something about. So there are tens of thousands of Australians who don't have access to the water quality that you and I would be prepared to drink. Okay, so the sort of thing that we would have in Canberra or in Sydney or Melbourne, for example.
Yeah, I grew up in Adelaide, so you gotta be careful.
So they're in remote communities. It's not just Indigenous Australians, but these people live in a lot of Indigenous Australians who are in remote communities, don't have access to what I would call safe, long-term access to safe drinking water. Yeah, that's easily fixed. We've got the technology, the ability to fix it. We've got the wealth to fix it. Yet it hasn't been fixed. Yet we have decided.
Because those people don't have the political capital.
Well, exactly. This is exactly the point you were raising, and I fully agree with it. And by comparison, this government, and I don't want to focus on this particular government, but this government has allocated last year billions of dollars for water infrastructure for essentially for irrigation. So we're prepared to spend money on water infrastructure for irrigation, but we haven't, and we're not spending the money to fix the water crisis, which is what it is, in remote communities in Australia. So it's tens of thousands. It's unacceptable that happens. And in the bushfire, Black Summer fires that we had in 2019 and 20, you know, there are estimates, and Sharon, I'm sure, has got the better information, over 400 people were going to die because of the smoke inhalation associated with that, asthma, various long-term issues associated. That's about half, a little less than half of the people who've died because of COVID-19. And the thing is, well, if it's just simply random, we could say, oh, well, that's the way the world went. Well, actually, it wasn't random because I've done some analysis. And again, this is an example of exposure. Those communities that had the lower socioeconomic advantage or the greater disadvantage had the greater exposure in terms of those fires. And so that's related to resourcing and where the resourcing went before the fires, all of those sorts of issues. So these are fundamental to the good life, so to speak, that many Australians enjoy, but many Australians do not have, simply because we have made the choices that we've made, not to allocate funds, not to do this, not to do that. And this is really the reset, the future that we need to have in Australia, not just for COVID, but just in general.
But how do we get to that reset? Because I think, for example, of the attitude that Australians have toward their fellow Australians stranded overseas during this crisis. A lot of politicians in both parties, so state premiers and politicians in the current federal parliament, seem to have taken the view that there is limited social sympathy for Australians trapped overseas. The attitude seems to be that they were wealthy enough to go overseas, or they had their chance to come back. Why should we make special arrangements for them? And politicians seem to have played to that to some extent, some more directly than others. But if that's the case about Australians overseas, and if that's what citizenship really amounts to in this country, which I must say I'm quite surprised and a bit depressed about, it's an indication of how we might feel about Australians here who are suffering lifestyle-related diseases that we talked about, you know, obesity, substance dependency. How do you design public policy to address or to get around the fact that there is an attitude that if people inflict harm upon themselves, It's not up to the state, not up to the rest of us to sort of dig them out of that hole.
Well, I suppose a couple of things there. There is some lovely work being done, led by colleagues down in Vic Health, in Melbourne, with others who have seen. So, just I've got two examples. So, one around sort of diabetes and obesity, where really the commercial drivers. You know, you look at the aisles in the supermarket, and I'm told, Sharon, we have more choice than ever before. I'm like, yes, we've got more choice of junk food than ever before. We've got more choice of booze than ever before. But these are just, the shops are full of that rubbish. So it's not about, for us at the individual level, making the choice. You've already curated my choice, i.e. within the retail environment. So there's work that's been looking at public sentiment around the commercial determinants of health, is the language of, and that's very related to obesity and diabetes. And the public sentiment is, we don't like the fact that some of the big food industries, alcohol industries, and it was the same back with tobacco, we don't like how they're shaping our society. So there is public sentiment saying we want something done about that. So when governments say, well, we can't intervene, actually the public is saying we would like you to intervene. And the other example I would give is, you know, all the discussion that's going on at the moment around raise the rate, you know, with job, I was confused at job keeper, at job seeker.
I just can't remember,
the figure's gone out of my head, but there's an enormous public support for increasing that rate, the job seeker rate.
And right across employer groups and market economists and social welfare groups, political parties, even the Nats, I think, at one stage were advocating it. Now, they have done it, to be fair. They have increased it, but it works out to, what, about $4.50 a day, $25 a week, I think.
Yes,
And which is certainly better than nothing, and I think a lot of people
would say. I think about 8 to 9% increase, I think, something like that.
I might just say, no, I don't think it's better than nothing. So that figure is still going to mean that people will be living in a family with children, will be living on a tea bag so that their children can eat food, and so that their children can have others come and play with them. There's beautiful work that's been done by Anglicare, by ACOS, and others across the country that have really illuminated the food poverty, the fuel poverty, just the inability to lead a decent, regular life. And that figure is not, you know, the pathetic increase is not going to make a difference. And so I would say, what the financial insecurity that many populations in Australia are going to continue to experience is pushing them into conditions that are going to be so bad for their health and will kill them. Those groups with that level of financial stress are the groups who die early. I come from the east end of Glasgow, where men died before the age of 50, and it was because of the financial poverty and the hopelessness for the future. There's a public policy, there's a social policy that could, we know financial capacity is really good for the economy, and we also know that it's really good for people's physical and mental health. I would say do something in that policy area that isn't going to cost you an awful lot of money in the short term, but you will reap incredible financial benefits into the future, and you will also prevent a major health burden on the healthcare system in the future.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what Labor does on that, whether Labor has a different policy. That increase is slated to cost about $9 billion over the forward estimates of the budget. That's not nothing. That's a fairly significant ongoing outlay.
I think it's worth highlighting for the people who are on that. I'm not on it, and none of us are in this situation, this podcast. But it's an increase over the base rate before COVID. It's a decrease, of course, from what they were getting, and a substantial decrease from what they were getting last year. The second thing I'd raise, and they're not disconnected issues. So there are homeowners. I'm a homeowner. Okay, so I'm one of those beneficiaries. We've had house prices, depending where you are on the country go up 8 to 10% over the last few months, projected to go up maybe up to 15% in some places before the end of next year. How did that happen? Well, there's a variety of explanations, but one of the key factors is our interest rates have dropped down to essentially zero. And they dropped down to essentially zero because of COVID. Mm-hmm. So there are people who have benefited to the tune of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So when you say interest rates have dropped and this is increased demand.
Increased demand, asset prices, not only in terms of the housing market, but also in terms of equities, for example. So people who had wealth are now substantially wealthier after COVID, 12 months after this pandemic got underway, than they were before. And it's a crazy thing, but it happens to be true. So couldn't we just think about it? And we didn't earn that wealth. It just happened because of the nature of what's gone on in terms of interest rates and other things as well. Mm. So couldn't we think about the people who have actually really suffered, as Sharon was highlighting? They're the ones who've suffered. Bunch of Australians have done very, very well in terms of their wealth. Can't we work out some system of actually helping them? I mean, that would be a fair society. It seems to me a very small proportion of that wealth increase could go to fund a whole range of different activities, it seems to me, without anyone being worse off compared to where they were in the COVID. That's still everyone. It would be a win-win-win as far as I could see. I don't see that on the table, though.
Hmm. Look, we're right out of time. I just want to ask you one very quick question just to get your impressions given where we've been taking this discussion. Would you support a sugar tax?
Well, would I support
I mean, this has been introduced in other countries, right?
And incredibly successful in other countries. It's been incredibly successful in other countries also because there's a whole suite of other policy measures as well. A sugar tax in and of itself will not solve the obesity and diabetes problem. A sugar tax as part of a complement, a suite of policy responses would be fantastic.
And I expect the economists to say there's a price signal in it at least.
Well, the idea is you tax bads and, you know, subsidize goods, but Sharon's point is well taken. If you're poor and you're being taxed on the food and the cut that you're currently consuming, that doesn't really help them very much, does it? So it's a question of what do you do to provide alternatives and support in those ways.
Look, it's been absolutely terrific having both of you here, Quentin Grafton and Sharon Friel. Thanks for being with us again on Democracy Sausage.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Mark.
And if you have any thoughts for us, you can contact us on Twitter via @appspolicyforum. That's APPS Policy Forum on Twitter. Or email us at podcast@policyforum.net. And you can even get to us on Facebook by typing the words Policy Forum Pod into the search bar. So until next time, that's all for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.